If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
And we are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson, the other voice you hear, he is essentially the audio historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Landon Coons is the man that puts everything together for us. And we call the show Beyond the Bricks. And those of you who participate by listening to it, it is most appreciated. We have fun each and every month when there is activity at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, doing a show that takes a look back at the personalities, the colorful characters, and the audio clips that accentuate all of it and tell the story of this, the greatest sporting venue in the world and the greatest race in the world, within now 1 week of the 110th running of the Indianapolis 500 mile race. Mike, this is a show that I know is one of your favorites. It takes us back to a Saturday night or a Sunday morning or a Thursday night, whatever it might be, when you were a kid dialing up that phone, trying to be caller number 9, whatever it might be, to make your favorite musical request on the radio. And we're doing basically all request night tonight, Mike.
That's right. We would try to call in and get Men Without Hats, the safety dance on the air, and call multiple times. And sometimes it would work, and sometimes we'd end up with Dexy's Midnight Runners like you would want. So it was a mixed bag.
The mixed bag, of course, can only be let off properly whenever you're doing a request show with the great Casey Kasem.
Now, we're up to our long-distance dedication, and this one is about kids and pets and a situation that we can all understand, whether we have kids or pets or neither. It's from a man in Cincinnati, Ohio, and here's what he writes. Dear Casey, this may seem to be a strange dedication request, but I'm quite sincere, and it'll mean a lot if you play it.
Now, Mike, this is a deep cut.
This is a deep cut, and unfortunately, we can't play all of it because we would lose our license if we played all of it. Now, we can play a small excerpt of the rest of it, but I mean small, like 10 seconds. That's all that's available because the rest of it's pretty profane, if you will.
Casey was not pleased that the long-distance dedication was the memory of someone losing their beloved dog as a pet, and Casey was less than pleased at the musical taste that led into the long-distance dedication.
We can't come out of a slow record. I don't understand it. Is Don on the phone? Okay. Now, make it, and I also want to know what happened to the pictures I was supposed to see this week.
This actually, Mike, the reason we're playing it, this is exactly the post-studio phone calls that I make to you each and every time I'm on my way home from Beyond the Bricks.
That's right. Is Mike on the phone? I want to know what happened to the pictures I was supposed to see of Beyond the Bricks.
That's right. That's right. I knew we were talking about him. I knew we were talking about Lewis Strang, but where's the photo? Is Mike on the phone? That's exactly how it sounds each and every time we're on our way home. All right, let's get to the requests themselves. Sam is in Lawrence, or was in Lawrence, and Sam wants to know, even though there aren't any more Andretti's entered in the 500 and won't be for at least a few years, of course, now with Marco Andretti announcing his retirement in the offseason, is there really an Andretti curse at the Brickyard? Well, we decided to queue up for Sam this actual clip from Robin Miller, the late, great Robin Miller, and author Bob Gates and public relations ace Steve Shunk all answered that question about the Andretti curse.
And he almost had a two-lap lead in 92. Almost a two-lap lead. So just the Andretti curse. I think it goes back to Clint Bronner's wife when Mario quit Bronner and went with McGee. Clint's wife put a curse on him and said that and Andretti will never win the Indy 500 again. And
is that right?
They never have.
Wow.
And what wishes have you made that have come true over the years?
Not enough, but I'm working on it. Think of that. The Andretti family has won. They Marco was second. Michael was second. Mario was second in 81, although.
Won 500.
Right.
And, with Clint Bronner.
Right.
Yeah.
But that was always the story, was that Clint's wife put the voodoo on him. Which, wow. I mean, when you think about all the things that have happened to him, you're like, I don't know if I believe in witchcraft.
Look,
but
look at Jeff in, what was it, 92?
Yep.
His crash.
Right.
Somebody put some voodoo on him.
They did.
Now, one of the great photographers at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is Chad Smith. Great dude, by the way, and a very talented photographer. You'll see him walking around the Speedway. You have seen his photos, unquestionably. And Chad wanted to hear more about when the Speedway was an aviation depot during World War I. Here's Donald Davidson with that story.
Because I know that when they finally came back and said, all right, the 500-mile race is on for 1917, it was only like a couple of weeks before then they canceled, because now the United States had got so deeply involved in the war that that they suspended and didn't have it in 17 and 18. And then the answer is, what happened to the track? Well, it became an aviation depot. I think there were three battalions that were stationed here, and for a while, I thought that they bivouacked in the infield. Well, it turns out that there were barracks just south of here. So if you go down Main Street to approximately where Delara is right now, and just south of that, that's where the barracks were.
Wow.
And but they worked out of the infield, and it was a refueling depot. There was a run that went from Dayton, which I think might have, I don't know if that's too early for Wright Field. It was too early for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Say that, but I think it was Wright Field by that time, and then also there was a McCook's Field in Dayton, so I'm a little hazy on this for the moment, but anyway, there was a run that went from Dayton to Urbana, Illinois, and the planes couldn't, they didn't have the capacity to do that nonstop, so they would actually stop in the infield at the Indianapolis Speedway to refuel, and there were several experimental aircraft out of here. I mean, this is have I got a couple more minutes for
sure?
Segment? Okay.
We were supposed to break 2 minutes ago, but
down,
go ahead.
All right. Well, maybe we should make it a two-parter, but down on Main Street, there used to be Bouchard's trailers. Remember, I don't know if you're probably too young to remember those the ads that would run the drive-in movies, but anyway, Bouchard trailers were all over the place. But his office was down on Main Street, and somebody said, you got to go talk to Mr. Bouchard because he's lived in this area his whole life. So I went down to talk to him, and he told me, he said, I remember when the Speedway Lumber Company, which was owner of 10th and Main, where the hospital is now, or where the healthcare place is, that used to be the Speedway Lumber Company. And he said they would build planes down there, and then an engine from Allison Engineering would be installed, and then they would tow the plane with a horse-drawn cart, towing it down Main Street, which was dirt, with the plane on the back of the flatbed, and then tow it over here, and then they would take off. They had a monorail on the infield.
Now, Mike, next we go in proving that Beyond the Bricks is a national broadcast, thanks to those that listen in podcast form. We go to the East Coast for our next question, correct, Mike?
That's correct. Bill in New Jersey, he has seen a picture of Wilbur Shaw, and it's actually a fairly famous photograph. And Wilbur Shaw in the picture has a lion cub with him in the cockpit of the car. And Bill wanted to know whether the lion actually belonged to Wilbur Shaw, if it was Wilbur Shaw's own pet, or if the lion belonged to somebody else, which I thought was actually a pretty good question.
A caller a few nights ago asked about Wilbur Shaw's pet lion, which he did not have a pet lion, but we thought we had that one figured out. And our friend Rick Schaefer called called and left a message a couple of days ago thinking that maybe the caller was confused between Wilbur Shaw, who made appearances with the Lion Cub, and Roscoe Turner, Colonel Roscoe Turner, the aviator, who did actually have a pet Lion Cub that that he used to drive around in the car in the passenger seat. And when it passed away, he had it stuffed and was in his living room, I believe. So it's possible that that's what the listener was thinking of. Anyway,
Jake, I actually am pretty sure that the lion did belong to Roscoe Turner that's in the picture with Wilbur Shaw, because Wilbur Shaw was sponsored by Gilmore at the time. And I think the lion's name was Gilmore the Lion. So I think that the lion cub in the picture was Roscoe Turner's lion, and they just basically borrowed it for the photo shoot.
And of course, Gilmore the Lion, not to be confused with Jim Gilmore, that would later run with A.J. Foyt, some probably three Lion lifetimes later in the 70s at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. All right, let's get to Derek in Arizona. Derek in Arizona would like to know, we know about the fact there was once a racing dentist, but Derek says, wasn't there once a racing doctor in the Indianapolis 500? Actually, Derek, that is not legend. That is fact. Donald Davidson can elaborate on that one.
Dr. Shattuck was, I think he was in Louisville. I don't know if he ever practiced in Indianapolis. But I think he would come here for me and then work the race. This is in the 20s. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what his experience was. I mean, there's some strange stories back then, but he drove in the 1925 500. I mean, he was on the medical staff in 1924 and driving in the race in 1925. So I don't know what else he had run before that, but he ran 25, 26, and 27. In fact, he was ninth in the 25 race, and he ran a number of board track races. And then in 28, he was a relief driver for Henry Collard for the Elgin Piston Pin Special. And in fact, Henry Collard, who is listed as the driver, only drove the first five laps. And then Shorty Cantlin and Doc Shattuck shared the car for the rest of the race. And that was the end of his racing career. And I think, actually, when he was, and I'm a little hazy as to whether he was in Indianapolis or not. He might have been at Methodist, but I'm not sure. But anyway, when he was in Louisville, I think he headed up the psychiatric ward in one of the hospitals. And then he was in California for a while. And in his later years were Oklahoma City or somewhere like that. I don't want to say Wichita, Kansas. It seems to me that he was out near an Air Force base, but he died in 1962.
Jake, can you imagine that today if somebody was on the medical staff 1 year and then the next year they actually drove in the 500 and then they drove in the 500 several years after that? To me, that's one of the most amazing stories in 500 history.
It is, no question about it. And it's one that you can imagine the amount of coverage today, if that would happen, how many just overall human nature stories there would be about that, right? No question about it. Now, we are obviously not doctors, but we are surgically working our way through this episode of Beyond the Bricks. And when we come back, some of our favorite spots, including hearing from Sam Posey, Jackie Stewart, among others, all of it, when we come back to this request version of Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Summertime is get back to clean time for Stanley Steamer. We clean it all, tile and grout, carpet, upholstery, area rugs, wood floors, and air ducts. Call today at 1-888-STEEMER, because it's not clean till it's Stanley Steamer clean.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
We'll be back to pick it up now in just a minute. Now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
The Big Country. In this country, a man grows a healthy lust for living. He may drive a pickup or a Cadillac, a Jeep or a GT. He may still be working on his first million or his second. He comes in all sizes. Comes from Tulsa or Turkey Peak. From San Antonio or Hunter's Creek. Fort Worth or Fort Davis. The big country is his home, and he's proud of it. He's the kind of a guy you like. Honest, but full of fun. He's the kind of a guy who drinks Lone Star beer. Get the big taste from the big country. The brand is Lone Star.
Always a favorite, the Lone Star spot from the Indianapolis 500-mile race. We are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Kip is in Texas and sent in that request because, of course, when you're in Texas, you want to hear a spot for Lone Star. He is not the Lone Star, is Kip, in the state of Texas. But who does not love hearing that ad from yesteryear? Now, Brian is not in Texas. He's in Westfield, but he is a fan of Kevin Kogan. And Brian writes in to say, I thought I heard a clip from sometime in the 80s, maybe the year after that 1982 crash at the start of the Indianapolis 500 that, of course, A.J. Foyt so famously said, probably Coogan. And Kevin Kogan was always blamed for that start of the 1982 Indianapolis 500, the crash at the beginning of the race that took out not just A.J. Foyt, Mario Andretti as well. Now, Mike, you were unfamiliar with this clip, but you did find exactly what it is that Brian's asking about, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The next year, they did Jackie Stewart had been moved to this kind of race command central thing in 1982, and he really didn't like that role that much. And they moved him to this race command center, and he did this situation where he introduced a piece that Sam Posey did, and Sam Posey had been somewhat critical, if you recall, in the 82 tape delay broadcast, where he said, well, he looked like he turned into him intentionally, which obviously was not the case, but the two of them did this piece together, and it was actually pretty interesting where they sort of theorized what happened in the crash, and they talked to Kevin Kogan, and it's actually a pretty interesting piece about what may have happened in the 82 crash.
As the cars accelerate for the start of the race, watch Kevin Kogan swerve, collide with A.J. Foyt, then ricochet into the path of Mario Andretti, thus triggering a chain reaction all through the field. Neither Kogan nor anyone else was seriously hurt, but the dust had barely settled when the accusations began to fly. A disgusted Mario Andretti shoved Kogan, then made it clear he thought the young driver, in his inexperience, had made a driving error. Next came an exchange with A.J. Foyt. For Kevin Kogan, Indianapolis 1982 was a black day.
It's been almost a year now since the accident, but in that time, no clear-cut explanation of what happened has ever come to light. We're here in the home of Kevin Kogan, who was the central figure in that incident. Kevin, set the scene for us, if you would.
What happened was the right rear CV joint broke, which basically connects the gearbox, the powertrain, to the wheels, rudely speaking. And what happens is anytime something breaks in there on one side or the other, because it's a solid rear end, both wheels are being powered. When one isn't, then you only have power going to one side of the car, which forces the car one way or the other.
All right, now we have a monitor set up here. I'd like to have you have a look at that scene again.
Okay, we're coming out of turn four, just starting to accelerate from a little bit of a slow pace, getting into second gear and accelerating. And as we come down, the part breaks here, and then it pushes the car to the right. The right CV joint let go, making the front of the car go to the right. And if you see in this angle here, watch the front of the car, and you'll see it actually sliding over to the right. It's a very good angle for that. And right here, as the part breaks, watch the front go to the right. Just like if you were turning to the right. And after I careen off of Foyt in front of Andretti, he actually made the accident a lot less severe than it could have been. I could have hit that inside wall much harder.
Why didn't you come forward at that point with this explanation?
Well, The reason why is actually something I can't answer personally, because if it was up to me, I would have had a full explanation immediately. You know, as soon as we inspected the car, I wanted to make sure we checked the car over and everything like that. I was being very cautious. I didn't want to say anything just off the top of my head, just to throw off anybody. So I was very careful to say, okay, let's look at the car, make sure before we say anything, and then we'll go to the press. Well, we went to look at the car, check it over, and it was basically what I had just described, and it was decided not to say anything, which I thought was a mistake.
Who decided that?
Roger Penske decided that.
It's pretty difficult to go back a year and determine what caused an accident at the start of the race. It's unfortunate. I know Kevin has felt bad about this. He probably feels that was one of the reasons that he isn't driving for us this year, but when you look at what happened, we had an accident the first lap. Those cars were run all season long with the same pieces on them. We didn't have that type of failure, and I hope it was that, because if that's the way he felt it is, that's probably what happened. And I think he's a great guy. In fact, I talked to Dan Cotter about Kevin, and I said he did a good job for us. But when I had an opportunity at the end of the year to pick Al Unser, who was a good road racer and had won three Indy 500s, I really didn't have any choice.
Jackie, you were one of the first people to talk to Kevin back in the garage after the accident. What did he have to say to you then?
He was very confused. He'd had a lot of static from a lot of other drivers. When I walked in, he asked me if I had seen the accident. I said yes. He said, did AJ hit me? That was his first question, which was one of confusion, obviously. And I said, no, but did something break in the car? And at that very moment, he picked up on that very abruptly, in the hope that I think that there may be something in that. Now, whether something broke or not, I guess we'll never know. But he was grasping at straws at that time.
Well, exactly. We may never know what happened there. But one thing is for sure. The career of a young driver at Indianapolis was altered irrevocably by what did happen.
Now, as a bonus to that, here is something that was not requested, but Mike unearthed it. It's 1986, and it's Kevin Kogan talking about that 82 crash and what it was like to be booed at racetracks after it all happened.
We asked Kevin Kogan what it was like in 1982 when, after the Indianapolis 500, he was booed at various other tracks around the circuit.
It wasn't pleasant. I went to some places, for instance, Michigan, which was owned by Roger Penske and the 500 there, and when they did the driver introductions, I don't know how many people were in the stands, if 70 or 90,000, but I'd say 99% of them jumped up and booed, and fairly loudly. You know, it's an amazing feeling. I think unless you've had 90,000 people boo you, it's hard to really appreciate what that feels like.
Now, Mike, the next clip that we have here comes from Aaron in Bluffton, and he had a question about a couple of drivers that sometimes people get confused.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he says he's from Bluffton, but he didn't say if it was Bluffton, Indiana or Bluffton, Ohio. I used to spend a lot of time in Bluffton, Ohio because they had an old car meet, and my dad would take us to the old car meet, and we stayed at a place called the L&K Motor Inn. And you can imagine how the high quality accommodations the L&K Motor Inn was. But I just want to point out that Aaron, I wish you would have said whether he was from Bluffton, Ohio or Bluffton, Indiana, but he said we could choose whether we talked about Fred Frame or Floyd Roberts because he wanted to hear about some winner from the 1930s. So we chose Floyd Roberts for tonight, and Donald Davidson has Floyd Roberts' story.
Floyd Roberts was the defending winner. He in 38 everything went right, and 39 everything went wrong. He was kind of a late bloomer because I got to think about it. He won the race. He was 37 years old, and he made his debut in 1935, and. So he would have been, 34, and he looked quite a bit older. But, you know, racing was a young man's game at that time, and he didn't really sort of blossom. He'd been running for quite a long time. And then in 1934 at Legion Ascot Speedway, he just really got going and finished second in points to Rex Mays. So he came back to the Speedway to make his debut, drove the Abels and Fink Special, and finished fourth in 36. He drove the Bird Piston Ring Special for Lou Moore, and formed a very strong relationship with Lou Moore. In 37, he was going to drive for Kelly Petillo, and they came to a parting of the ways, and Petillo decided to unretire and drive himself. So Floyd Roberts drove for Jewel Thorne. What he didn't let on was that he had an accident earlier in which his arm was broken still healing from a broken. He effectively drove the 37 race with one arm, with one hand. All right, 38. He qualified for Lou Moore, who was now retired as a driver. The Bird Piston Ring Special qualified for the pole and won the race. And it was a real Cinderella story because at 37, that was getting a little long in tooth for a driver at that time. And, you know, basically he'd had a kind of a rough go of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, the last two or three years, well, actually 34, 35 were good seasons. 36 and 37 weren't. And he won the race. And he won the national championship. And then in 39... he and Curly Wetteroth, who had built the 38 winner, they built another car, which Floyd Roberts partially owned with Lou Moore. He also worked on the cars, and there's a wonderful photograph up in the Photoshop that we really need to get more use of Floyd Roberts sitting on the ground in the garage, working on the rear end of the car with grease all over him. And this is the defending Indianapolis 500 winner. And anyway, he had a hard time making the race. I think he started 23rd and was maybe a couple of laps down when he came upon the scene that Bob Swanson, who had just taken over from Ralph Hepburn and just got a couple of laps, lost control coming out of turn two, flipped and got thrown out onto the track. Several cars coming along behind, and one was Floyd Roberts, who just turned to the right to try and avoid the accident, went over the fence and didn't look. It's on film. The car doesn't get upside down. It bounces along. It doesn't look like that bad of an accident, but in reality, he hit his head on the... but they didn't have a headrest, but somehow or other the back of his head hit the bodywork right behind him, and he ended up, you know, he losing his life. And so a couple of little pieces of trivia. He was from Van Nuys, California, and it was another 500 winner from Van Nuys, Johnny Parsons. The trivia is that Johnny Parsons' second wife, Myra, went to school with Floyd Roberts' daughter. And so when that happened, you know, Floyd Roberts had already won the 500, but Lila didn't know that she was going to end up marrying a guy that would also win the 500. And then another little anecdote here, so we're probably, I don't know, try to get one more call in, but Duke Nalon was somebody I came to know very well, and he said that in 1938, he actually shared a room with Floyd Roberts. And he said the day after the race, he came back and said, well, you know, I had to turn down a deal today because I was offered to $500 to endorse Chesterfield cigarettes. And Duke said, well, what did you have to do for it? He said, just stand there with a cigarette and they take it. And, you know, like they used to do with Joe DiMaggio. And he said, well, why did you turn the deal down? And Floyd Roberts said, are you kidding? My grandmother would kill me if she knew I smoked.
The other option there, by the way, going into that was Fred Frame. That, by the way, was the very first driver that Donald Davidson ever mentioned on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio network. As for others whose names and voices would become synonymous with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Four Course from the X Post Twitter, as I call it, wrote in to say that he had once called into Talk of Gasoline Alley years ago to hear about the great Jim Phillippe and would like to hear about him again. Donald Davidson and Kevin Lee have the story from the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Yes, Jim Phillippe, golly, he was on the PA for years, and typically what he would do, he would do interviews. In fact, he interviewed me when I was on the PA my second day at the track the Sunday, the second day of qualifying, and I was on the PA with Jim Phillippe and Fred Agabashian. Jim's role was normally to do the post qualification run interview. So when you came in, that's who you were interviewed by, and got to thank all your sponsors and everything like that. But let's see, he was I'm going to get myself in trouble here. He was a professor at Butler.
Correct.
I believe.
Yes.
In fact, I think Tom Carnegie had done that for a while, and then Jim Phillippe came in when Tom stopped doing that. I believe that's right, but for a number of years. I'm trying to think of the people now that I have that went into the business, both locally and, you know, in other parts of the country, that were his students, if that would be the correct term.
Well, but some would be like Dave and Kevin Calabro.
They were okay.
Scott Hoke went to Butler, I believe. Yeah. Those are, and I'm sure I'm, and some of the, you know, like a Rich Nye went to Butler, but I don't know if Jim was still there. These are Indianapolis people, although Kevin Calabro is a national guy. He's one of the top play-by-play guys in the country.
Oh, yes. In fact, Kevin...
Most know Dave is now the lead public address announcer.
Kevin actually was the host of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. He wasn't the first one, but one of the early ones. I think I was with him for, golly, 4 or 5 years, I think.
Yeah, and a big race fan. And I saw him out at the track a few years ago. And for those, he's in the business that I'm in, and there's nobody better at this than Kevin Calabro.
I'd love to see him again.
Yeah.
It's been years since I saw him. But another thing Jim would do was he used to do the memorial, mm-hmm. and was part of the pre-race ceremonies very much. And then he would do the lead in to whoever was saying, "Gentlemen, start your engines." And
if you look at a lot of the pictures, you'll see Jim there.
Well, it was funny because you had Jim, and then you had Luke Walton was doing it for the radio network, and the two of them were both talking at the same time, and both hopefully that they would end up with a tie when it was time for the "Gentlemen, start your engines." But Jim was a great guy, and golly, look at all the people that he interviewed, but that voice was very distinctive, and a lot of people miss the when he used to do the memorial on race morning when it was on Memorial Day.
It's an all-request party night, if you will, on Beyond the Bricks, and we'll take a couple more requests on the other side.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
If you've tried diet after diet and nothing seems to stick, you're not alone. TrimRx is a convenient telehealth platform designed to make getting support feel simpler and more realistic. You start with an online assessment. A licensed provider reviews it, and if you're eligible, medication is shipped right to your door. No waiting rooms, no confusion about next steps, and no price increase as your dosage changes. Plus, you get ongoing support along the way. Right now, you can get $120 off your first order. Visit TrimRx.com to see if TrimRx is right for you.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
And we always, always thank Quality Supply and Tool for keeping us thinking outside the box. Also to the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, where you will find us. So we are not outside the box where we think with Quality Supply and Tool, but rather inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Thank you to both, and thank you to all of you as well for listening to this all-request night of Beyond the Bricks. Jake Query along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons. And Mike, as for the next thing, so much of the audio that we have, so much of what we do is, of course, courtesy of the great work over the years of Donald Davidson. And you've got a great clip of Donald talking about just exactly the history of that.
Yeah, what's interesting is we get a number of requests saying, you know, what's the history of Talk of Gasoline Alley? How did it get started? When did it get started? And things like that. And honestly, we get too numerous to even mention all the people who have ever asked us about that. So I thought tonight what we would do is let Donald himself answer what was the history of the talk of Gasoline Alley. How did it get started?
They didn't call that to begin with. In fact, I don't think that title came in until about fourth or fifth year, I think. So we'll have to... I know we had some the working titles. The early ones were Stump the Chump, and Lou Palmer called it Do It to Donald, and Chuck Riley called it Stymie the Limey. That was when we were. That was when it was a quiz program to give away prizes. But we managed to work out of that. After 3-4 years of doing that, I asked the people involved at the time, and I said, you know, some of these answers. Right now, we're just doing rapid fire question and answer, and you either win or you don't. And I said, some of these answers. There's an anecdote that I'd like to tell. And so they said, oh, that's okay. You can tell the anecdote. And over a period of one season, I managed to massage the program. So I just did anecdotes and no more call-in. But anyway, at some point, it was called the Talk of Gasoline Alley. And that might have been, we finally moved to the garage area because we did it in studio at the various locations. And then the first time, was it 82 or 83, we were actually at the track doing it out of the garage.
Oh, you were in the studio for the first decade plus.
Sure, okay. Yes. I mean, we used to be, this is ancient history now, but we used to be on North Illinois.
Yeah.
And around the time when they moved up to 92 North Meridian, it used to be 2835 North Illinois. And so then we actually did it in the lobby of the Speedway Motel one year. I think that was 83. And then we moved into the garage area proper. So we had a couple of years with the old garages and right by the phone booth in a Goodyear tire depot. Mm-hmm. And with a bunch of tires piled up. And then by 86, then we were in the garage area. And we did that actually for many years. We would be aligned with the team. And I really miss those days with the noises in the background, and occasionally an engine would fire up, and you'd hear the PA, you know, chief mechanics, bring your pop-off valves to USAC.
Yep.
I miss that. But,
In the 60s, was there any kind of show that was a part-time show? Were you a regular guest on the radio station in the late 60s?
Well, actually, in 1966, we did one on old WIBC 1070. Uh-huh. It was Sid Collins' idea, and it was called Dial Davidson.
Okay.
And it was a call-in show, and it was 15 minutes. It wasn't enough time. And then the next year, we didn't get to do it because when I had emigrated, I had to register with the local draft board. And as luck would have it, I was on basic training. Yep. Believe it or not, I was an American fighting man as a British subject. And so in 67, I couldn't do the show because I was at Fort Rucker, Alabama, and I didn't get back here until May 23rd. And then the next few years, there was no show. And then 1971... there was this sudden surge at 1070, so that's when the forerunner of this program began, and then the qualification coverage with Lou Palmer, and then later on Bob Lamy.
People are going to want to know, what kind of soldier was Donald Davidson?
Oh, well, I was a little out of my element. The physical part was a bit of a struggle.
As it would be for most of us. As it would be. All right.
Josette in Blacksburg, Virginia, one of our longtime listeners, said she wanted to hear about the time that Sid Collins interviewed famous dancer. Now, tell me who it is that we are hearing that Sid Collins, because he talked to a ton of dignitaries and entertainers. Which one is this, Mike?
That's right. Now, earlier this year, we did our annual tribute to Sid Collins, and Josette reached out to me and goes, are we going to hear Sid Charisse tonight? And I said, no, unfortunately, we're not going to hear Sid Charisse. And she put in a request for All Request Night to hear the famous dancer and actress Sid Charisse. And so that's what we're going to hear now is Sid Collins and Sid Charisse. It's a Sid and Sid interview clip.
Thank you very, very much, Floyd Davis. And our young lady is sitting down beside me here. Make yourself comfortable, man. right back here to the right, if you will, because we have a very charming girl who's going to go down to Victory Lane in just a few moments. Not a few moments, about 25 minutes. She'll start making her way down there in just a few moments, and she'll be on hand to kiss the winner of this year's 500-mile race. Hi, Sid.
Hello, Sid.
This is a privilege I waited for many a year, to have another Sid.
Well, this is an exciting day, mine.
Hey, don't you look lovely? You want to tell our ladies coast to coast what you're wearing?
Oh, a jersey dress, sleeveless.
And what color is that?
Beige.
I know it wouldn't be brown or tan. They have to be something like beige, Roman. And blue sunglasses.
And blue sunglasses.
How do you like the 500? I know you and Tony wanted to come for your honeymoon to see this race, and now you've waited 9 years to make it.
It's more thrilling than I thought it was going to be. It really is wonderful today.
You think you might bring Tony Martin back with you one of these days?
Yes, without a doubt.
Next year, we hope.
Yes.
Who are you rooting for out there? So you have your program, and it looks like Hollywood Park.
Well, I think perhaps Sam Hanks is going to do it. It looks to me.
Well, he's a good boy from out your way, you know, mm-hmm. Pacific Palisades, California, and Jimmy Rathman's from Florida. So it's kind of a California-Florida duel today.
Yes, it is.
You're late.
I was sorry to see Troy Ruttman out of the race so soon.
He's one of the popular boys in the West Coast, too, isn't
he? Yes, he is.
Have you had a good time in Indianapolis? Have you enjoyed yourself?
Oh, such wonderful hospitality. I've enjoyed it immensely. Everyone's been so nice to me.
I noticed yesterday, when you came to the driver's meeting and made your very nice talk, that you put your footprints in the cement, just like Grandma's Chinese, in your silk stockings.
Right. We have a picture coming out, silk stockings.
That was a very clever move. Most of the girls always step in that cement in their bare feet, you know.
Well, I was very wise.
I'm glad the movie wasn't called Clodhoppers or something. It wouldn't have been too attractive. Although I think they'd look good on you anyway.
Thank you.
We've always enjoyed Meet Me in Las Vegas and all your other past movies, your dancing, your singing. We'll look forward to Silk Stockings, too.
Thanks.
And I hope that we'll be hearing from you. Charlie Brockman right over here. I'll be down in Victory Lane. Get a good look at him, because when it gets crowded, he'll be putting you on again down there when you talk to the winner. All right?
Bye.
Thank you, Sid. Right.
Bye.
Goodbye. That was Sid Charisse, MGM movie star, who is here to award the BorgWarner Trophy and to give the victory kiss, and she promises a great big fat victory kiss to whoever it may be in Victory Lane about 35, 40 minutes from now.
Another longtime listener of the program is Mike's dad, Rick in Toledo. A longtime listener because he's contractually obligated to do so because, as I mentioned, he's Mike's dad. Now, he loved the MG liquid suspension cars of the mid-1960s and would like to hear more about them. Since, of course, Mike is the one that picks the topics and audio for the show, guess what? Of course, we fill the request.
It was Shell Quavali, and that's K-J-E-L-L, and good luck getting Shell out of that, but that's how it was pronounced. I don't know a great deal about him, except that he had a dealership. He was an importer of British motor vehicles, and in San Francisco, I think, but I'm not 100% positive on that. And then in 1964, there was the MG liquid suspension specials. And because I'm non-technical, there were three cars that were built by a man named Joe Huffaker. And whether they employed the MG liquid suspension or there was any part of that in use in the race cars, I don't know, or if it was merely a sponsor, I was never clear on that. But they actually had one for Foyt. It was a rear engine car for Foyt with a number one on it, and he drove a few laps and said, I feel much more comfortable in the Roadster. And so the car that he turned down was renumbered and was turned over to Bob Weiss, who had a really good run. He didn't finish the race, and here I go with my oft-repeated statement, the box score never tells the story. Bob Weiss actually came up through the pack and ran third for a while with that car. Walt Hansken, as a rookie, drove the other one. The third one was Jerry Grant missed the show. Actually, they had four. No, they had three. Pedro Rodriguez crashed one, and so it was Bythe and Walt Hansken in the race, and then they were back in 65 with Jerry Grant and Bob Bythe again and Walt Hansken, and then they had new ones in 66, which looked markedly different, and they didn't have the success that the 1964-65 ones did. although I think their success was at other tracks. And then Tassie Battis That was the basis for the Finley cars with Wally Dallenbach a little bit later. But I will say one thing is that in 1964, the team manager was Peter DiPaolo, the winner of the 1925 500.
So there it is. Happy Father's Day, right, Mike? Job well done.
That's right. We were able to get that in. And actually, those MG liquid suspension cars did have the liquid suspension technology. And I'm not really a gearhead, but those things were pretty interesting. So if you get a chance, look them up.
The liquid suspension technology, same thing I believe they used in the astronaut pen. You'd have to watch Seinfeld to know exactly what I'm talking about there. For Landon Coons, Mike Thompson, my name is Jake Query. It's been request night, and my request to you is that you enjoy the remainder of the evening and join us again for Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Run a business? Then you know time is money. If your vehicles use Florida toll roads, ePass helps you save both with volume toll discounts and dedicated customer support. Sign up for an account today at getepass.com.